When the art day gets rough, you just gotta keep on punching. And here's your Thunder Punch Daily with Jersey Drozd.
Hey, it's me, Jersey, and it's time for your Thunder Punch Daily, the show that's recorded not so daily, where I share a few thoughts from the mind of a cartoonist, namely me. By the time you're listening to this, if you're listening to this over the weekend, I will be on my way. Well, actually, I'll be in Lexington, Kentucky. I'm going down there for a meeting with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning to finalize some plans for the UpFair, upfair.org, this coming November. And also, I'm going to, you know, take the opportunity to treat it as a little bit of a social call on my buddy Sarah Turner, Knife Man. And I'm planning on bringing the video camera with me and possibly shooting some video when I'm down there for the next Art and Story Supreme video from me. We'll see how that goes. But as I record this, I'm recording this just before I head off to a workshop in Southfield, Michigan, which is about 45 minutes away from where I live, at the Specs Howard School of Visual Arts and Design to do a workshop on dynamic visual storytelling, in particular, with a particular focus on manga techniques. Now, this may seem weird to some people that here's this guy with this Eastern European name who is as white bread as can be, and he's going to teach you about manga. Yeah, I got the I don't know if it's irony, but it's sort of an incongruity. But I have spent a number of years studying manga techniques. I consider sort of like my college years, my time at Antarctic Press. I did a bunch of books for Antarctic Press in the mid to late 90s up until about 2002. And throughout my time there, it was, it was emphasized that they would prefer that I work in a manga style because Antarctic Press is one of those American companies that produces stuff in the manga style. For better or for worse, I'm not going to make a value judgment on this, but unfortunately, there's always going to be people who ask you to defend your choices, defend different things in the arts. I say that's unfortunate because as artists, as cartoonists, people who write with pictures, one would expect that we would be a very open-minded group of people who embrace any new interpretation, any new inroad, any new way of looking at our beloved art form because they're expanding the scope of what it can do. But unfortunately, there are people who feel, for whatever reason, my guess is that the reason most of the time is that they're defending their own choices, and a great way to defend our own choices is to say, not that. But unfortunately, there's still some resistance here in the United States, and I'm guessing elsewhere. There's resistance to this notion that manga is as valid and awesome a storytelling, comic storytelling style as anything else. And the way I look at it as a guy who dabbled in it and learned a lot about it through doing it, I think it's not only just as valid, but there's stuff that we in the West can pick up and learn from and incorporate to create more effective comics. And some of the things that I'm going to talk about in just a minute here, I'm hoping to point out some of the ironies in people's resistance towards manga, because I think manga borrowed, or at least worked parallel to, cartooning principles that were in existence in the West for decades. But anyway, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this opportunity, since I had to put together some notes for this this class I'm about to do anyway, I thought I'd share some of these notes. I would have preferred to video the class, but I'm not able to do that this time. So what I'm just going to do is just document some of my notes for you guys. This is the kind of stuff I'm going to talk about in my class today. So advantages of manga. I'm going to make a case for what things I've learned from manga that I think are really cool and things that I think the traditional Western style, especially the superhero comics these days, are missing out on by adhering to, by only looking in their own little provincial pool. I guess that is, I was going to go on a sidebar about like the attitude in North America about the arts in general. But I don't want to do that because one, that's neither here nor there, and two, that would be a broad stereotype that I'm sure isn't exactly true. So anyway, advantages to manga. One of the number one advantages to manga that I think they have is the flexibility of cartooning. This has been said elsewhere, but I played with it a lot when I was working for an Arctic Press. If you want somebody to be really angry, you have that extra latitude to take a realistic face and stretch it to impossible proportions. Now, this is, again, this is a tried and true cartooning technique in the West. Look at Disney cartoons. Look at the work of Carl Barks. Look at even the UPA-style animation, where it was, you know, highly design-focused, but still, they played with that stretching. Chuck Jones cartoons. There was, you could have somebody's head balloon out, their mouth practically fall off their face with to express an extreme emotion. Now, granted, that's extreme. And no, I'm not going to play the explosion. But in that is only appropriate for certain kinds of storytelling. But I think we can look at that as a guide to say, maybe we could be a little bit more flexible in the way we draw people. After all, we're rendering people with lines. It's already abstracted, right? But also you can play with the size of the character. You know, if you want somebody to really emphasize, like, okay, let me just paint a picture in your mind. High school student, he's hitting on a girl, leaning against the locker, saying, you know, smarmy things to win her affections, and his girlfriend, his steady, catches him. And so we can render her as standing behind him as he's making the moves on this other girl. She's suddenly much taller, her head's bigger, and her face is contorted in a very stretchy, cartoony way to emphasize how she feels about that moment. Obviously, that's not how she looks, but we can show the true magnitude of her rage by making even her head five times larger as her body stretches to a taller stature. This is used a lot in manga. Rumiko Takahashi does this in her books, even in her more quieter books like Meizanakoku, which is one of my favorite mangas of all time. She plays with this a little bit. And I did this in a backup story I did for Ninja High School, where Hitomi, one of the main characters, is being hassled. She walks into a analog for the Walmart stores, and there's the little old woman at the entrance who is, you know, the greeter. And the greeter is trying to give her help. All this different. Can I get you a cart? Can I help you find something? Take a circular, dearie. You can't find what you want in the store without a circular. And Hitomi turns to her and says, No, 1,000 times no. And her head gets huge, and she draws her swords, and her body stretches in this kind of like snake-like arc, and she gets very large to emphasize the full extent of her rage. That is a pretty cool thing that you get to play with for comedic effect and for subjective emotional effect in manga. And in the more realistic, not real, not realist, not truly realistic, but approaching the realm of realism that is sort of celebrated in American traditional comics, that would just seem way out of line. But let's go back 50 years. That was used as a technique in cartoons and comics for many years before. You know, we've talked on the Art and Story podcast about guys like Jack Davis, who really plays with proportion and size of characters' body parts to caricature them, make a caricature of them. You know, he has big hands, big feet, big heads, and relatively spindly bodies. Why is that okay? But when manga does it, it's not okay. And I think this is something where people are getting hung up on surface features of style and not really understanding the mechanics that are going on underneath. Now, extending out this thought on this flexibility of emotion, there's also this really cool technique where you can express the inner emotion of the character through subjective backgrounds and symbols in the backgrounds. I remember my buddy Hoover took me to task for a panel in the front. It was at the end of chapter 2. I believe it was page 20 of chapter 2. I don't know what page it falls on in the graphic novel. And after Thirsty has gone through this madcap chase to get his Thor pin back from this girl that he doesn't know, he discovers that the pin that he was chasing wasn't his at all. It was her. She just happened to have the exact same pin. And Knox, his best friend, returns Thirsty's pin that he lost earlier in the story. And when he realizes that he went through all this trouble and all this agony to get something that wasn't even his, he has a freak out. He loses his crap, for lack of a better term, and he screams. And I stretched out his face. I dropped his jaw really far, and I protruded his lips out almost like a duck's lips. So his teeth were like almost flying out of his head with the force of his frustration. And then I put a ring of fire behind him, like as if he was on fire. Again, trying to emphasize that inner rage, that inner frustration. And my buddy Hoover, he was like, oh, jeez, man, just why don't you just make it a, go ahead and just make it a manga at this point. But the thing was, because I do maintain that the front is not entirely manga. I think it is, I'm proud of the fusion that I found in my own style and using manga techniques with American techniques. But yeah, that was off-putting to some people that I was willing to go that stretchy. But the first couple chapters featured a lot of that because it was more lighthearted and comedic as it began. As the series got more serious and dark for me, I stopped doing that so much. Not because I didn't want people to call my stuff manga, but because the tone wasn't appropriate for that kind of comedic stretching. I was using it as a visual cue to emphasize the difference in tone. And that's something that we have as an option in comic storytelling, depending on your style, of course. Now, a quick asterisk, side note, sidebar in the textbook. I think a lot of independent artists who are being published by the trade book publishers and also companies like First Second, Top Shelf, Hyperion, etc., I think they're playing with these tools and with this kind of looseness of cartooning. I don't know if it's influenced by the influx of manga or if it's them looking back at an earlier time in cartooning's history and playing with those tools again. But it's interesting to me that these new independent cartoonists are playing with this kind of elasticity in the cartooning, whereas the traditional American comics companies just stay the hell away from it. That's a fascinating thing to me. And what's more is when you listen to some of the podcasts out there, I'm not going to name names, but there's some podcasts out there that are actually done by some of the traditional guys, and you'll hear them actually just rail against manga in an almost in a prejudiced way, which is too bad. I don't say it's too bad because manga deserves equal rights, but it's too bad that they're thinking in such a limited way. That's myopic. It's not insightful. Okay, another point about manga that I've discovered that I really enjoyed is the dynamism of movement. For some reason, when a lot of artists try to approach this very photorealistic representational style, often they lose, and I'm generalizing here, okay? I mean, I want to make that absolutely clear. I'm absolutely generalizing. So I know this doesn't hold true for every artist who approaches a sense of realism or approaches a representationalism, okay? So don't send me any emails. But often they lose a little bit of dynamism in that representation. I don't know why that is. Maybe it has something to do with the role of line itself. Let's go back to the Art and Story episode that we just recorded, the Visual Cues series episode 2, Line, where line itself is a communicative vehicle of energy, tone, emotion, etc. But for some reason, because manga has that elasticity of its cartooning style and often tends to be, but most of the stuff we see in the United States tends to be kind of an open line contour kind of style without a lot of rendering except that's done with tones. Their characters' movements seem a lot more dynamic, but I also suspect that it's something intrinsic in the way they approach their moment choices. I just did, as I talked about in the last Thunder Punch Daily, I had a discussion with Dan Mishkin on the Comics Are Great show, that new thing that I launched, that new experiment, and he was talking about how in moment choices, we choose moments and the readers infer a few seconds before and a few seconds after. And that is a fascinating thought to start considering these, what moments we choose. And I bet we could sit down and look at some of these moment choices. I'm not talking about McLeod's chart of aspect to aspect, moment to moment transitions, or even like, showing the environment versus showing the character. I'm talking about showing a character choosing between the different range of movements that you could be displaying in the shot. I noticed that at least in the shonen manga, which is the manga for boys, the poses tended to be a lot more dynamic, which kind of like spoke to the mainstream comics of 25, 30 years ago, like the Rick Leonardis, where everything was dynamic. His characters don't walk across a panel, they dance across a panel. And I don't see that as much in traditional American comics, which is kind of a bum out to me. That's something that I think we can look to manga a little bit and start investigating. What are they doing to make their characters look so dynamic? And they're not all jumping around. I'm talking about just them walking down the street. They look more like they're moving than a lot of American artists. That's interesting to me. And that's something that I've worked very hard to try to capture in my own work. And then there's the dreaded speed lines, burst lines, blur lines. Speed lines being the line, you know, the character's running and the background turns into a blur of lines. I use that a lot in my work, and I think because I think it's really cool, and it's very dynamic. The burst lines is like a burst coming out from behind somebody, like somebody's punching somebody in the face, and the entire background will be rendered as a burst, or to show somebody's shock, like, what? My mother is dead? And, you know, you have a big burst behind them to emphasize that emotional moment. But then there's also blur lines. So, like, if a character's jumping at you, the leg, like, it's almost like a photographic effect. Like, the foreground elements of the character, their arm that's coming at you, their face is in perfect focus, but that leg that launched them in the air will be rendered as just little blurry sort of speed lines rendering the outer contour of the person. I did this a lot in the front too. I played with it at least a lot, and I mean I picked it up from, again, working for Antarctic Press. This is a really, really cool use of line, and I don't see what the problem is. Yes, it becomes sort of an idiosyncratic sort of stereotype of manga, at least the shonen stuff, the boy stuff. But, man, when something becomes that widely used, it's probably because it's useful. They're not just doing it to shake a Japanese flag in our face and say, ah, look, we do something weird. It's important to stop. This is the analytic eye stuff I keep beating on again and again and again. Stop, look, consider, why are they doing that? And is it useful for the stuff I do? I think it's a really cool mimicry of photographic effects. And I think because we are dealers in line most of the time, depending on our style, these kinds of line effects, I think, are more effective than using Photoshop effects. Photoshop effects, I think, become incongruous with line work because it's applying a photographic technique, a pure photographic technique, like actually blurring it, you know, blurring the pixels to replicate the kind of blurring you see in a photograph, onto a sort of symbol system that has dealt primarily, historically, in lines. So for the person who rails against manga and rails against doing Photoshop blur effects, I'm going to ask them to evaluate which one's the more effective technique to mimic photographic blurring. I'm going to say the blur lines. So those are just a couple of things. I mean, I'm already running long here, but those are the couple of things that I find absolutely fascinating about manga. There's way more than that. There's also the way they use their paneling. There's the way they rely on tones. There's the preponderance of black and white comics there, and the way that they've answered that technological hurdle by creating comics that are appropriate to black and white instead of demanding to be color. I got an email recently from somebody who just read the front for the first time. It was a young woman, if I'm not mistaken, and she was commenting on how, despite the fact that it was a superhero comic, because I had some manga elements and because it was in black and white, she gave it a chance and she found that she really enjoyed it. And she said if it would have been a full color, glossy, sort of all the characters are shiny kind of superhero comic, she wouldn't have given it a read. So that's another thing to consider, is that there's an audience out there that can enjoy your superhero story, because the front is a superhero story. I make no apologies for that. But because of some stylistic choices I made, it reaches a broader audience than the traditional superhero comics reader. Things to consider and things to examine. So I'm going to go ahead and recommend that you go out and, if you haven't before, go out and read some manga, and don't read it in that kind of begrudging homework way, but just flip through a few and see if something grabs you. And I'm not saying this to be as some kind of like political statement of give this a chance, give these people equal rights or any of that kind of nonsense. That's not the reason you should read it. You should read it because it's good. And I'm telling you that I think it's really good, and I think there's some terrific manga out there. It's just a matter of going out and looking and finding it. And then when you see something that happens on the page, and you go, that's nice, ask yourself what they're doing there. And you're going to be adding to your visual vocabulary and thereby becoming a better cartoonist. So who am I? I'm Jersey Droz, J. Droz on on the web, Jersey on the Twitters. Hey, guess what? Thank you very much for your support of this project. We could not do this without you. It means the world to us that you guys are willing to compensate us for our time in making this extra content, and I'm having a blast doing it, and I'm having a blast talking with you guys in the forums. So thanks once again. We really appreciate it. All of us do. So I will be back soon with another Thunder Punch Daily. Until then, remember, everybody.
In today's story, you saw how the Widgets were fooled by Evelyn's disguise. They learned that bad things can be made to look good, and why we should always be careful and question everything that doesn't seem right. But it works both ways, and that's why the saying "you can't judge a book by its cover" is so important. What it means is that appearances can be deceiving, and you shouldn't judge books or people by the way they look. It's what's inside that really counts.